Okay, any preliminary questions? Some of you already know this from I don't know where, but in any event, I should have told you to keep your exams, that is, as opposed to throwing them away, and eventually give them back to me. So to the extent that you have made paper airplanes out of it, so be it. But if you still have it, you're welcome to copy it, do whatever you want with it, but sort of for archival purposes or what have you, we keep the old exams. So some of you already caught me to try to give them to me or give them to my secretary or what have you, but sometime over the course of, either today or next week, give them to me in class or drop them off with my secretary. Same thing will be true of the midterm exams. I'll hand those back to you, and when, I don't know. I've been thinking about that, I think it's most realistic to think of getting your midterm exams back a week after Monday. Anything sooner than that, I don't think is realistic. I'm certainly going to try, but I'd rather err on the side of caution here. Any other preliminary kinds of questions or issues? Okay. Questions about the exam, for that matter, on Monday. Okay. Well, then let's switch over to the middle part of Chapter 3, Section B, beginning on page 42. We've done a catalog inventory of the types of damages in the first section. And one of the reasons for doing that inventory is that it turns out that in the other sections like this one, we differentiate between some types of damages that are recoverable and some that aren't. So we continue to refer to things like economic damages or non-economic damages, compensatory, punitive, etc. So we'll see that throughout this section. But the major issue we have in this middle section would be the extent to which you want to identify persons other than the immediate victim of the defendant's negligence as persons entitled to compensation. And we start with, in many ways, the easiest case, wrongful death, easy in the sense that, well, of course, we have to compensate somebody other than the decedent. The decedent's beyond our ability to compensate. And so we have to fashion some sort of substitute. But after we do wrongful death, we start looking at cases in which we are not limiting it just to cases where there's no one else to compensate, but where we say, even after you've compensated the immediate victim, are there other people who deserve to be compensated? Spouses, children, bystanders, etc. Okay, so wrongful death also takes us back to sort of the historical origin of much of tort law and raises the same question that we had, we've been asking all along, which is the relative role of judges in shaping the common law, judges deciding cases as they go along based on what seems good to them in a particular case, and then sort of looking retrospectively, what is the pattern that has emerged? How can I conform this case to patterns I already see in the law? that whole common law evolutionary process as distinguished from the legislative process in which people make judgments prospectively. This is the way in the future we want things to be, and writing on a relatively clean slate. That is, the legislature is free to change things, adopt new things. It isn't bound by conformity with the past in the way the judges strive in their decision making to not to create new law, but simply to articulate what is already present in other cases. So, Moraine versus States Marine Lines here. Can somebody tell us about that case? Mr. Nelson. Okay. And now she's appealing the ruling that says, in effect, I'm sorry, lady, the law gives you no remedy. Okay, now to analyze this case, it might be helpful to sort of just do a historical review, tracing the law of wrongful death from its earliest phase in English history up to the date when this case was decided. But let's start at, you know, what's the beginning of this story?
Was this, when you go back to the old common law?
Yes.
If there was a wrongful death that was involved with, it was usually a felony that was committed, and felonies under English law were put to death and all of their property went to the court or to the crown or the court?
Yes, to the crown.
And so then there's no chance to recover because all the property's gone, so why even bother with that?
Yes, this was known as the felony merger rule. Now, many people have in the back of their minds the felony murder doctrine, which is sounds a lot alike, but is a very different doctrine. You may know from studying criminal law or what have you that when a death occurs in the course of a felony, the law treated that as a form of murder as though it were premeditated. So if I go into a grocery store with a gun, an unloaded gun, and hold up the guy at the cash register and he backs up and falls down and hits his head and dies, that was considered murder even though there was absolutely no intent on my part to cause a death, and the gun was unloaded and so forth. This was an accidental death, but since it occurred in the course of committing a felony, an armed robbery, the law would treat me as though I had walked up to him and shot him in the head. That's the felony murder doctrine. And occasionally I'll see that on an exam explaining the law of wrongful death where it, alas, does not belong. This is the felony merger rule. Felony merger rule was the idea, as you expressed it, that that there was historically, in the earliest days, or at least prior to the kinder and gentler days of the modern era, there was no point in talking about wrongful death actions because if somebody did something wrongful enough to cause somebody else's death, they had more to fear than a civil lawsuit. As you pointed out, they were treated as felons. Felons were capital crimes. They were put to death. Their goods were confiscated. So a civil plaintiff had nowhere to go. As the law in England became kinder and gentler and no longer treated all wrongful death as so harshly, there came to be a window of opportunity there where a civil plaintiff could say, you negligently caused my loved one's death, and I want you to compensate for that. And when someone proposed that to the courts of England, what was the response? Okay, but the case that we have that essentially considers whether to award compensation in the event of wrongful death.
Oh, in this case?
No, not in this case, but the first English case that we have reported on that subject is what? Our old, not, well, he will soon be our old friend, our new friend here, but we'll see him again, Lord Mansfield. What does Lord Mansfield say in Baker versus Bolton? Anybody have that handy there? The holding in Baker versus Bolton is Ms. Russell? Yeah, Lord Mansfield said, we don't do that. It's not done here. And so the earliest response to the suggestion that there was a sort of common law right to recover for wrongful death was met with, no, you don't have such a right. Now, that's not the end of the story, but because this is Baker versus Bolton has a lasting effect for reasons we'll talk about in a moment. But what was the next chapter in the story? So, in essence, here it's impossible. Here the court says, well, no, we're not going to do that. Next chapter in the story is Mr. Beauvais? Okay, and so it had been modified by statute. The next chapter in the story are these so-called Lord Campbell's Act. That is Parliament intervenes and says, the courts tell us there is no wrongful death recovery. Well, we say there is. In the event that there's a death caused by tortious conduct, here's the remedy that we provide. And this in turn was imported into the United States through a variety of statutory provisions for wrongful death. So to the extent that in Baker versus Bolton the court said, go down the street, go to that building that says House of Commons, House of Lords, not the one that says courthouse, the people did just that, persuaded legislatures to adopt statutes authorizing recovery for wrongful death. These were imported into the United States, and we have an act passed by Congress. What's that? What's the act that unfortunately doesn't cover Mr. Moraine? Okay, it's called Death on the High Seas Act. So Congress, among other things, passes, and this is just one of many, alas, that doesn't cover Mr. Moraine. So the defendant's argument in this case is what?
It was the negligence of the...
No. Okay, but why is there no remedy for Mr. Moraine, according to the defendant? Not that it's his fault, but essentially, when Mr. Moraine asks a federal district court to grant him, or when his widow asks for that court to grant a recovery for the negligently caused death of her husband, the defendant says, but Your Honor, you lack the power to grant such a recovery. If it were to be, it could only come from Congress. Congress has passed a statute, but we all know, says the defendant, that wrongful death recoveries come only from legislatures. They may not be created out of whole cloth by courts. And of course, the plaintiff says, I disagree. For example, is there a statute that says, in the event that someone is in an intersection collision and has their arm broken, they may recover damages for that broken arm? No, there is no such statute. How is it that people persuade courts to permit compensation for broken arms in intersection collision cases? Through the common law. Because historically, judges have done these things. Why is it that in the case of wrongful death, we can only act where there has been a legislative act, a statute authorizing it, says the plaintiff. And the defense says, well, that's the way we've always done it. What is the court... Now, in addition to this sort of generic argument, the defendant points to a long-standing precedent. What's the case that... the Harrisburg. Again, this is something, what is it, in the 1860s, or what's the date of that case? Anybody have that handy here? 1886. This precedent has been around for a long time, saying, in effect, hey, wish we could help you out, but we can't. Go down the street, ask Congress to enact a statute that covers not just death on the high seas, but death in the inland waterways. Again, it's a kind of anomaly here, or just a, technical oversight. It's not as though Congress consciously said, only people who are injured or killed, only people who are killed on the high seas outside the territorial waters of the United States, only those people can recover. But if you're killed in an accident within the territorial waters, those people don't deserve a recovery. But the Harrisburg said, in effect, who are we, the courts, to make such a remedy out of whole cloth? What does this court say? Yeah, they overrule the Harrisburg. They say, it's not as though we are acting contrary to some congressional intent. If Congress passed a statute that said we don't want people killed on the inland waterways to get a recovery, or if we had some indication that this was pursuant to some, preference, but as far as we can tell, it's just an oversight. The fact that every jurisdiction has a statute providing a recovery for wrongful death takes us back to this one, back to Baker versus Bolden, as you were saying earlier, from the time it was decided, people said, to themselves, what kind of nonsense is this? How is it that if you break somebody's arm, the courts have an inherent power to provide a remedy, but if you cause such an injury that the victim dies, you as a court lack the power to make any remedy. You have to wait for the legislature to enact the statute. That's kind of a dumb principle. Again, the larger question, this case is often cited in discussions about the relationship between legislatures and courts, as this is certainly an example for those people who think that courts should have more flexibility in updating the law that they interpret and apply. The fact that when I was in law school, my torts professor, Guido Calabresi, was working on this very issue and this book, and wrote a book called Common Law in the Age of Statutes. In fact, I think I referenced this maybe in the notes. No, I don't. But there is such a book, Common Law in the Age of Statutes, which is essentially asking, as legislatures get more active in codifying traditional areas of the common law, what is the proper response of courts when the legislative scheme has holes or anomalies or inconsistencies? Are courts essentially prevented from, disabled from improving the law as they used to do through a common law method, or should courts continue to sort of exercise their judgment in fixing aspects of the law that seem to need a little tweaking here and there? And again, this case is an example that sort of puts the question, did the court do the right thing or did the court do the wrong thing in saying Mrs. Moraine gets a remedy for her husband's death? Okay. This long history is in part sort of for just giving you a sense of perspective about the way in which the law develops. Yes, we have certain principles today, but it's helpful to kind of see where we've been. We'll see Lord Mansfield again in Chapter 5, because he plays a role in the growth of the doctrine of contributory negligence. But again, the law doesn't develop in a seamless, straightforward fashion. It looks more like, it's sort of the difference between you drive around Spokane and there are these long north-south streets and these long east-west streets. You go to Boston, and the streets are all, they didn't grow up through some sort of straight line. People developed this way and that way, and the streets are quite adventurous in their organization, shall we say. And that's sort of the story of the development of the common law, or of our tort law in particular. It follows these kinds of, at every given point, things seem to make sense at that time, but you can't follow a nice straight line. Okay, and again, the major point to be learned here is that it's all about a statute. What did the legislature choose to include or to leave out of the remedy? And because we don't have the same logic that we do in the case of a broken arm, one of the reasons why courts could, in effect, create a remedy for a broken arm out of whole cloth is that there's a certain logic to it. The economic damages, the pain and suffering, the future wage loss, the medical expenses, all of these things have a certain, the property damage, they all have a certain logic to them. When you're talking about wrongful death, it's a little more difficult to say, well, exactly what logically fits with a recovery for wrongful death. And for that reason, I think you could find some merit in Lord Mansfield's determination in Baker versus Bolton that that this is a case that requires the legislature. We can't do it on our own. That having been said, we now turn to some statutes where we begin to look at the essentially the menu of options. It's like installing a piece of software where you get a series of options. How do you want to do this? What here are the different things you could choose, and different people will want different things. So let's start with the First National Bank of Meadville to explore, as the district court does in that case, the statutory framework for assessing the damages in a wrongful death case. Can somebody tell me about Mr. and Mrs. Rice and their two daughters? Ms. Russell. I'm sorry, a little louder, please. Okay, and let's, before we get into the particulars of this case, let's get a more wide angle focus here and kind of ask the bigger question. As we prepare, or you know, if we were sitting at the legislature making up a statute for wrongful death, what's our menu of options here? What kinds of things do we have to decide with respect to this the format of the recovery? Okay, one would be the, in effect, the what. What do you recover? Economic damage? Non-economic damage? Loss of relationship? Later in the chapter we'll talk about loss of consortium. Consortium is often thought of as sort of spousal or sexual kind of relationship. But consortium more generally means simply society, like we speak of a consortium of oil companies. So that term, consortium, loss of society and companionship, may be parent-child or some other important intimate relationship. So that's one question we have to answer. Do we include non-economic as well as economic damages? There's another important question we need to decide in the form of a wrongful death. Yes, it's a question of who. Who's the beneficiary, or who are the beneficiaries of this action? Again, the point at which wrongful death, or one of the significant differences between offering a recovery for wrongful death and offering a recovery for a broken arm, when it's someone whose arm is broken in an intersection collision, we know that the person whose arm was broken is the one who's entitled to compensation. It sort of, you know, goes without saying. On the other hand, if you have a case of wrongful death, it's not at all obvious who ought to be able to recover. Now, there are two main forms of, if we can speak of wrongful death sort of generically, but there are two major forms of statutes authorizing a recovery for wrongful death. And what are those two? In terms of the identifying the beneficiary or the who question. One kind is a survival action. And And the other one you said is a wrongful death type statute. And these are sort of labels that lawyers put on them to try to classify the type of statute we're dealing with. When we refer to a survival action, it's very easy to confuse that with the survivors. It's not that. A survival action is the survival of the cause of action. It is essentially on behalf of the estate. As you know, when someone dies, we create this legal entity, an estate, which is sort of the legal, I sometimes refer to it as the ghost of the decedent. This is that person's will or spirit that lives on for legal purposes. Through this legal mechanism of the estate, we try to carry out the wishes of the decedent. So if you're Howard Hughes and you die leaving your money to the guy from the gas station who gave you a ride, supposedly, we want to make sure that the money goes to him. Or if that's a forgery, we want to make sure it doesn't go to him and goes to the people he really wanted his money to go to. Now, again, this concept here is that the primary beneficiary of the wrongful death claim is the estate, which otherwise represents the decedent after death. And whatever the decedent told us by way of testamentary documents through a will, living trust, some other kind of legal mechanism for the disposition of that person's assets, that's what we want to follow through this wrongful death recovery. An alternative view is this wrongful death idea. Who's the beneficiary of the wrongful death action? Yeah, essentially the family. Right away, what problem can you see with this kind of a recovery? Yeah, we live in a time when families are sort of touchy, you know, less distinct than it might have been at one time. A century ago, family meant spouse, children. Today, family means maybe something a little more open-ended. Those people with whom the decedent was, you know, somehow intimately related. And that in turn, you know, requires us to do all this kind of stuff of evaluating, you know, a person's. I'm trying to think who recently. You know, Katharine Hepburn. I don't know who Katharine Hepburn left all her money to, but you know, Katharine Hepburn dies, and you know, does Spencer Tracy get her money? Oh, he's dead too, but, you know, I mean, what do you do with the fact that, again, in 21st century America, people's lifestyles don't always match up with the categories that the law has specified in terms of traditional spouse, children, etc. What do we do with that? Now, again, the legislature, in selecting one or the other of these fundamental directions, has to decide, in effect, okay, given the options, which is preferable? Do we want to focus on those living persons who can demonstrate that they have suffered a loss because of this person's death, like Mrs. Moraine or whoever else might show up, the Mrs. Rice and her two and their two daughters? Or do we want to say, let's keep this the same way we treat other assets of the decedent, and simply follow the mechanism either specified in their will, or, as we do in other cases where people die without a will, and we create we have a default setting again, like installing a piece of software. You can hit the click the express box, and it'll sort of give you all these default options. This is what most people want most of the time. You can go back in and change this if you want, but here are the default settings. So a typical statute for what they call intestate succession, in fact, in some previous cases, you will have a reference to the plaintiff's intestate. What that means is that you don't have a will. You haven't provided a testament. So you died intestate, and so we have principles of intestate succession. Or, again, what happens if somebody hasn't left us a will? Well, we say half of their estate goes to their spouse if they have one, the other half to their children. If they don't have a spouse, then it all goes to their children. If they don't have a spouse or children, it goes to their siblings or their parents or, you know, what have you. This is the way we do it for people that die without a will. So, again, the survival action focuses on the estate and letting the cause of action go where it will, according to the wishes of the decedent if they were expressed, or our default settings if they're not. Again, by contrast, the focus over here is on the loss suffered by identified family members. If you followed the case, in fact, I referenced this at the end of the materials here someplace. Don't I? Isn't there something at the end of the chapter that I've got here? I think I've got an older version of my own materials here. Let's see your book here for a second. Yeah, great. After we get this stuff, yada. Oh, I don't have this in here. Huh. Okay, there's actually a more recent version of this. It differs in only about 3 pages, and this is one of them. But that's fine, doesn't matter. You may recall a case about 2 years ago involving the death of a woman in San Francisco from a pit bull. She was mauled by the neighbors who had this pit bull, and it was pit bull or was it? Rottweiler. Okay, yeah. Okay. So anyway, a ferocious dog, ferocious by nature. In any event, the owners of the dog, I believe, were criminally charged with manslaughter, I believe, and I think they were convicted. Case later thrown out on appeal or reduced to, I forget what happened with it. There was also a civil claim by the domestic partner of the decedent, A domestic partner, another woman, said, I'm entitled to a wrongful death recovery for the death of my beloved partner. And the defendant said, no. Under the statute, it's legal spouses who get to recover, and you're not a legal spouse. And so when she brought her claim, the district the trial judge said, in effect, you know, technically speaking, you got to be a spouse, but I don't think constitutionally you can discriminate between people who are heterosexual and get to marry and people who are homosexual and have a similar kind of relationship but aren't granted the legal status of being married. The defendant said, you can't do that, trial judge, and appealed it. And I think before the California Supreme Court had considered the case, the California legislature passed a statute, revised their wrongful death statute, and said, in effect, domestic partners are entitled to the same remedy as a married couple. Now, again, the question is, who gets identified in this wrongful death statute as persons qualified to recover? It is for the legislature to make that call. Now, with that in mind, let us turn to the Pennsylvania case here, First National Bank of Meadville versus Niagara Therapy. What did Pennsylvania specify as their choice for this kind of recovery? You started to tell me, and then I interrupted you with all this stuff. So go back to where you... Oftentimes, as you know, when I ask you these questions, you'll think, but I already answered that. That's okay. I either forgot it or I want you to repeat it. So so go ahead. What's that? But of these two kinds, wrongful death, survival action, what has Pennsylvania chosen as their method of doing this? Yes, surprising as it seems, you're looking at things, well, I would expect to see one or the other. It turns out Pennsylvania does both. There's nothing inherently illogical about that. Obviously, there's a potential for overlap, as we will see. But the Pennsylvania legislature said, in effect, you know, there are two different aspects of this. On the one hand, we do want to identify those family members who are entitled to a recovery. On the other hand, we want to identify that part of the estate's recovery that requires compensation. Okay, so under the wrongful death statute, we've got the who part of it. It's the family members. It's Mrs. Rice and her two daughters. Now we get to the what part of it. What do they get to recover? What kind of contribution? Okay. What about coming to their, you know, high school graduation or taking them on vacations or talking to them, and do they get that kind of contribution? Does Pennsylvania say they deserve to be compensated for that? No, as it turns out. The only form of recovery is for the economic damage that they have suffered. As far as Pennsylvania is concerned, Mr. Rice was a goose that laid golden eggs. And we count the number of eggs, you know, just like we did with Mrs. O'Shea. How many more eggs did he have in him that he was going to lay? And how many of them would have come to Mrs. Rice, and how many of them would have come to his daughters? And that's how much they deserve to be compensated. So on the one hand, Pennsylvania sounds very generous in that they say, oh, We want to make sure there's a recovery for wrongful death. We want to make sure there's a recovery to the estate. But on the other hand, it's extremely restrictive in the sense of saying, is that all that they have suffered by way of damage? Is there economic loss? As it turns out, Mr. Rice had a, you know, upper middle class income. He was a lawyer working, you know, I guess he was a corporate counsel. And you know, his income looks like it would be pretty good. We would do just as we did with Mrs. O'Shea, figure out how long he was going to work. It would be relevant, for example, that everybody said of Mr. Rice that he was just a genius about business, that there were other companies who were interested in having him come on board in an executive capacity, and he was headed for a six-figure, seven-figure income within 10 years. That was the trajectory he was on. That's the kind of, again, we've got to figure out how many eggs is this guy going to lay, so to speak. Mixing my biology there. In exactly the same way, it would be relevant to say he was a nice guy, everybody liked him, but he had a terrible drinking problem. You know, he'd come back in the afternoon and he'd had a three-martini lunch. And there were days when he came in and he'd obviously been drinking at breakfast. And everybody liked him and they were trying to figure out a way to get him some help, but there was also talk that if he didn't straighten this out, they were going to fire him from the company. And that would be relevant too, to say his career, instead of going up, was about to go right into the tank. That would be relevant. It's all a question, again, about what is this guy's economic future and what benefit would there be to Mrs. Rice and the children. Again, it would also be relevant to say Mr. Rice made a lot of money, but he and William Bennett would go off to the casinos in New Jersey and gamble it all away. He wouldn't spend it on his wife. He spent it all on himself. Mr. Beauvais. Again, this is all left to the jury. This is where, again, we're building on what we learned in Mrs. O'Shea's case. It's a pretty grubby business that we're in to try to give the jury the most accurate picture of where this guy was going. And it would be nice if we could stay away from it. I'm in a digressive mode here, so rare for me. But this is the point at which judges got out of the marital fault business. As you know, 50 years ago, to get a divorce in this country in most jurisdictions, you had to prove fault. So that, you know, the spouse that wanted to get divorced, if the other spouse didn't want the divorce, the spouse that wanted the divorce would have to prove marital fault. Typically, you know, the most common things were sexual misbehavior, but there were other forms of fault that counted. But judges, and then the distribution of things like alimony and child support was based upon essentially a determination of who was at fault for the breakup of this home. And judges got, I think one of the major reasons why the system of marital dissolution, the fault system was replaced with essentially a no-fault system in most jurisdictions, is the judges felt, what am I doing here? This is just really yucky stuff where I have to, you know, listen to all this testimony. You got these private, you know, investigators, and you know, please, this is just. I feel like I'm looking through a keyhole at somebody's private life here. Now, again, this is sort of the same thing we'd have to do with Mr. Rice. You have this testimony about what people, all this sort of gossiping, and well, I saw this, and you know, he was sneaking out over there and da 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 da. That's all relevant. It's pretty yucky stuff. But if we're trying to figure out what was Mr. Rice's future in this company, all that becomes relevant. We got to do it, really. And again, you could have alternatives, arbitrary sorts of awards, but if you're going to try to base it on your best guess as to what the future looked like, you have to wade into this rather questionable area about who was doing what. Okay, so one aspect of this is the wrongful death recovery, and again, you look at the statute here and there's zero, nothing about any non-economic recovery. If Mr. Rice had been very successful and had just finished his retirement party, you know, where he'd, you know, made a bunch of money, he had all kinds of stock options, the company was doing great, his family was well taken care of, and he was getting on a plane to go off for this long-awaited fishing trip on the Great Slave Lake in Canada, and then it crashed. The law of Pennsylvania would say, well, was he going to lay any more golden eggs? If not, hey, no damage. So you could be very critical of this statute in terms of its under-inclusion of damages. And the reason we started out this whole section this morning looking at the history of wrongful death statutes is to say you've been, I hope, along the way finding that the law, though it contains anomalies here and there, on the whole, the law follows a fairly logical path. Once your common sense is sort of educated here, you can allow your common sense to lead you in the right direction. We've now hit a major crevasse in that otherwise sort of smooth path in which suddenly we have these situations in which you look at it and you say, is the law doing this? Well, you know, they shoot horses, don't they? You know, they can leave somebody like this with essentially no recovery. If it had turned out that Mr. Rice was not a successful lawyer in the middle of his career. And we'll talk about that some more in the Feldman case. Okay, the wrongful death thing says essentially how much would Mrs. Rice, and they figure out, you know, how much had Mrs. Rice of the money that Kenneth Rice earned, how much of it did he bring home, how much of it was available to his wife, how much of it was available to his daughters? And again, we'd get into the same business. The question Mr. Beauvais raised earlier becomes relevant. What was the relationship with his daughters? Suppose one of his daughters had done something, or Mr. Rice had done something such that the relationship between them was estranged. The last communication between Mr. Rice and his daughter, you know, daughter number one, was, let's suppose it was, in effect, you know, you blankety blank, I never want to see you again. Would we say at that point, well, cross her off the list? On the other hand, people say things and then they reconcile. What's the evidence with respect to the likelihood that but for this plane crash, the two would have reconciled? He still would have paid for her college education, for her to go to law school if that's what she wanted to do, despite all this nasty stuff that they said to each other. Well, again, we got to get into all this messy stuff. I must say that from the plaintiff's standpoint, again, the yearning of the jury is for the story to end happily. If you're the defendant, you sort of have to root for the bad guy here. Ah, these people hated each other. They, you know, it was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf here. Well, even that story is full of surprising loyalty among the two, you know. You should see that movie, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. where life or art imitates life or life imitates art. In any event, the family dynamics become relevant to figuring out what is it that she's entitled to collect. After we get done with this, what else do we have to do? We have to figure out the survival act, which essentially says what would have been left over for the estate. So he gets this pile of money at the, you know, he earns this pile of money in his job. He brings it home. Some of it he makes available to his wife and to his children. Some of it he spends on himself. And the rest of it accumulates in his estate. And we calculate what would have been left over at the end of a lifetime of earning for his estate to then distribute to whoever it is that his estate designates. And in this case, again, the estate winds up going, it happens to go to these two individuals, the wife and the daughters. It's possible, however, you can easily imagine a situation in which somebody has another cause that they want to benefit. I'm trying to remember who Katharine Hepburn left all her money to. Anybody know? But suppose she had a cause. You know, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or, the Sierra Club, or whatever, that they said, this is where I want my money to go. Then that would be the party who would say, I want my money. The decedent says, this is where I want my money to go. And again, you have this question about where would the money have been spent if it hadn't been for the death caused by the defendant. So it's a bit of a roller coaster ride, as you can see, in a wrongful death case to figure out, particularly in 21st century America, where people have interesting family arrangements, shall we say. They marry, they divorce, they remarry, they live with people they're not married to, but they have children, they do this, they do that. How do we sort all this out to have a nice, neat package to say these are the folks and this is what they get? And again, you can ask yourself the question, if you sit in the legislature and you're drawing up the game plan here, what is it that you want by way of economic recovery, non-economic recovery, etc.? Questions about the general shape of things? Let me also say, as I think I said yesterday, that or the day before, whenever it was, when I test on wrongful death, and as I stand here, I don't know whether it's going to be on the test on Monday. I'm thinking it will be, but I haven't made that decision yet. I must say I'm inclined to think it will be, but I'm not sure. I will err on the side of caution, but I'd like to find a way to make this to make this work, to have it be sensible. The main thing I'm concerned about at this point is that reading statutes and dealing with them is, as I said before, a kind of a little art in itself. However, I would say that learning to read statutes is not that dissimilar from the other things that you have done, in that the primary challenge is, what do I know and what do I don't know? In the statute, it should tell me the who, the beneficiaries of this statute, and it should tell me the what, such that if my client is the girlfriend of the decedent, I should be able, reading the statute, to say either you're in or you're not in according to this statute. if he left a will that made you the beneficiary of his will, and it's a Survival Act statute, good for you. On the other hand, if the statute says that it goes to certain designated family members and my client is not one of those designated family members, I should be able to say, I'm sorry, you're out. There's a wrongful death recovery in this case, but it isn't going to you. I'm saying you should, in an ideal world, simply be able to pick up the statute and read it. On the other hand, part of what you have to keep reminding yourself is there something I'm not, you know, could something blindside me here? Is there something I haven't taken into account? Have I read the statute thoroughly enough to be able to at least identify where there's stuff that causes me question? The job of the legislator in writing a statute is to make it reasonably clear to the people who read it, but learning how to read a statute is, as I'm sure you've discovered if you've already tried this, not like reading, it should be like reading a recipe if you cook, which I, from time to time, am forced to do, much to my children's dismay. But if from time to time I try to follow a recipe, you know, I can do what it tells me to do. But of course, it helps a great deal if I've cooked similar kinds of things to be able to know that a dash of this and to brown this and to bring it to, you know, whatever it is, these sort of descriptions of things I'm supposed to be looking for are not quite like a quarter of a cup of vegetable oil. That's an easier thing to identify than, you know, cook until whatever it is, some thing that experienced cooks know what they're looking for, but I don't. So again, as you look at these statutes, you want to get an appreciation for, okay, I understand this part of it. This part's a little unclear to me. It seems to be modified by this later part over here, but I have to, again, be wary of leaping to conclusions before I've thought the thing through. General questions about this whole area before we take our morning break? Ms. Woodruff. We have a mix. It's more like a wrongful death statute in that the family members, it's a kind of traditional, you know, like the one I described for California, where spouse and children are the beneficiaries of, for purposes of economic laws. There is also the survival of the decedent's claim for pain and suffering. So if the decedent suffered before death, for example, through, you know, mesothelioma or some other, you know, long lingering, they're hit in a terrible automobile accident, they linger for 2 months and finally die, well, that pain and suffering is also recoverable in the statute. One of our alums, Dick Iman, who was at one point the head of the Washington State Bar Association and has been a very successful personal injury lawyer. He represented the plaintiffs in a case involving the crash of a helicopter rescue. I'm trying to remember. I think it was the Heart Flight. It came from Sacred Heart. It was a helicopter service out of Sacred Heart Hospital, and they're flying this, you know, emergency. Deal, and some goes wrong with the tail rotor on it, and it goes and crashes, and everybody aboard is killed. Well, he represented the decedents in that case, and he wanted a recovery and got one for the last, I forget what it was, 103 seconds from the time the tail rotor comes off as these guys are headed down knowing this is the end. You know, again, if you're a personal injury lawyer, you make a living on those 103 seconds. and he got the most that he could for his clients out of the pain and suffering. So again, legislatures can mix and match. Just like a recipe card may say, you know, I've got a recipe here for sauerkraut chocolate cake, which my wife used to make. It's very good, by the way. It's got to be good with a name like that, okay? But it does, you say to yourself, no, I don't think so. But yeah, okay, this is what the, if that's what they want, that's, I guess, what they get. But my alarm bells do go off to say, wait a minute, I must be missing something here because this doesn't sound right. Again, if Mr. Rice had been on his retirement dinner and you look, you look at the statute and it says, oh, his wife and children get nothing? Well, maybe so. So, again, we'll pick up with that, with the Feldman case, in 10 minutes.